Hello and welcome back to the Academy Podcast. My name is Aaron Mejias.
And I'm Daniel Grasso.
And today we are finally capping off our series on Fyodor Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. So if you have not listened to our last episode, please go ahead and do that because it is going to give the full context for what we are going to discuss in this episode and where we are pretty much just covering the last few pages of the book and giving them their full treatment. And where we left off last time was after a lengthy conversation with the prostitute Liza, the underground man fled the brothel and then ended up going home and going to bed. And then he awakes the next morning and pretty much puts on airs once more about his ventures from last night. He thinks it will go over quite well and pretty smoothly, even though we know for a fact that that was definitely not the case. And he pretty much dismisses his interaction with Liza, saying, "I was positively amazed at my last night's sentimentality with Liza, at all those outcries of horror and pity. To think of having such an attack of womanish hysteria, pah," I concluded. "And what did I thrust my address upon her for? What if she comes? Let her come, though. It doesn't matter." But, and you can jump in now, Daniel, that doesn't really seem to last too long, right?
Right. I mean, if you notice, the next sentence he says in my translation, clearly the chief, the foremost thing now is something else. I had to hurry and at all costs save my reputation in the eyes of Zhurkov and Simonov, his friends from, quote unquote, friends from last night. And so he immediately forgets everything, this like real human experience he had with Liza. And he's like, "Oh, that'll be okay. Like, I just won't think about it." And he just rushes around and he's trying to save his reputation because he horrifically embarrassed himself. And the reason he had gone to the brothel in the first place was to insult Zhurkov, to slap him and challenge him to a duel in this attempt, this romantic attempt to save his honor. And so that's the sentence here. And then if you go to the next paragraph, he's casually talking to his boss while he's borrowing money from him about how, "Oh yes, me and my friends were at the Hotel de Paris. So, you know, seeing off an old comrade, a childhood friend." And it's like, this is so embarrassing and cringy because he's literally just spent all last night literally pacing back and forth for 3 hours at how mad he was at these people. And now he's bragging to people who don't know what happened. Like, "Oh, yes, you know, a very casual affair. I eat at fancy restaurants with my very charming and handsome friends. Yes, you know, it's something I do all the time." And it's like that. It's just so scummy. And it's so scummy that he can convince himself that that's what happened so quickly. It's incredible to me. And then he immediately writes this letter in which he's so deluded once again. He writes a letter to Simonov, the friend from last night, closest thing he had to a friend going into it. And he thinks he's very suave and he's very good humored. And he writes this letter in which he thinks all will be forgiven because, he's just casually explaining how he got a little drunk. He wasn't used to the alcohol and, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I went past my proper limits," but in such a fancy and proper style that they would just immediately forget everything that had happened. So once again, he's immediately back into these literary delusions of his own action and how it's going to play out in the real world, which we just saw in the last two episodes that it didn't go that way. And already he's so quickly fallen right back into the same pattern.
But interestingly enough, the shell of the underground, let's call it a shell, you know, this man who exists underground and he seems to,
like, the physical place he exists in. Is that what you're trying to say? Barrier between him and.
Right. Right. Because I think of the underground as more of a metaphor for more of his condition in which he is a part of the world, but severely kept apart from it, in which he, and we'll talk about that more at the end of the book where he talks about his existence underground, right? And so not necessarily the place, but more of the fact that he, this kind of putting on airs, this trying to socially impress and be something that he really isn't, and this kind of paradoxical conflict that is constantly playing itself out in the way that he behaves, it has now been in a way pierced through because we're talking about this braggadocious behavior that he is putting on once again, talking to his boss, as you mentioned. And then there's a line, very specific. "The thought that Liza was coming worried me continually." and it seems like something has happened. There's a break.
Yeah, you're right. There's a very physical thing here too, where she has his address and no one, it made a point earlier saying that not even Simonov, one of the only people he had contact with, knew where he lived. And he kind of like lived off the grid socially. And that this is a big reversal now that someone, he's vulnerable and like someone can find him and meet him against his own terms, or terms that he's immediately regretted here. And so you're right. There is a sense of his hiding hole has been discovered, not even discovered, but it's been, he's handed out the address and the location and then immediately regretted it. But there's this immediate sense of vulnerability and anxiety that comes with that.
Right. Both in a psychological sense, right? In the way that Liza has kind of laid bare the inherent need of his condition, and I would say all of our conditions, in which somebody may need to be loved authentically and seen for what they are as flawed, but worthy of grace and forgiveness. But also in, like you said, the physical, because it's almost like internet trolls almost, where you can behave however you want if nobody knows where you are.
Yeah,
there's a sort of anonymity.
He doxed himself.
If we're going to relate it to modern terms, like she now not only has pierced the veil in the sense of just him as a person in that conversation in the preceding chapters, but more importantly, she knows where he is. And she can go to him and see the conditions in which he finds himself and truly know who he is. Because I guess like you don't really know a person until you see how they wake up in the morning.
Yeah. And I mean, he makes the point of saying that I posed before her yesterday as such a hero. And now, And so it's like he knows it. Maybe she doesn't. I don't think at this point she really knows how much he was posing. And she's probably kind of like, what was that deal? But like, what is he really like? And she wants to find out because he posed as this romantic hero. But he knows that not only physically is he posing and socially, that he really is kind of a dirty bum. But
right,
he emotionally was just, like you said, he was really just trying to trick her, just to crush her for no, out of spite. And he knows that, but she doesn't quite know that yet.
Right. He walks around in a bathrobe. He has a lowly servant who hates him. He lives in a pretty rough apartment. He doesn't make as much money as a civil servant. And instead of being able to, like you said, pose, and he poses in all of his life. You know, we go back to the original story of the German beaver pelt and bumping shoulders with an officer. All of that was, he was able to do that because of the fact that nobody cared where he was or who he was in his own personal life. And so he was able to constantly put on this exterior of what he wanted to be as he went out. But then if somebody were to come to him, they would know who he really was. Kind of a scary thought, right? And I think, and this idea of love continues to play a role in it, because if we can think about marriage, right? And we can think about inviting somebody into our home, in our living space, and live that out with us. There is an inherent invulnerability when it comes to this idea of space.
Yeah, right? It's like that time I lived with you.
Well, yeah, I mean, we could talk about that too, right? Because you and I have been able to develop.
You were a dirty bum.
Oh my gosh, please don't.
You're
please
Mr.
don't.
Bleach.
Yeah, seriously. No, but in all seriousness, our relationship has a certain quality to it because we lived together, because there was a vulnerability that was present to the both of us in which we saw how the other lived, adapted to the living situation for each other. And it created a different kind of friendship and a different kind of love. And it's the same thing in which, you know, a marriage may occur in which two people live together and you begin to see there's this absolute vulnerability in which the day-to-day living, the day-to-day routines are laid bare and laid open. And so your partner knows all your weaknesses. And even you've admitted when you started to live with Stephanie is that was that's a very strange adaptation to make,
careful.
Right? Oh.
Oh, careful. She's listening.
But I mean, you can speak into that, right? Like it's a strange adaptation.
Yeah, no, and you're... Yeah. all your habits or any weird habits or anything that you don't really think is strange, and all of a sudden you realize that that's not just how other people act all the time. But I think even it's even more potent when you consider it metaphorically, which I think is, you know, obvious in the story, more obvious than when you live with someone. But the idea that she's going to see his heart of hearts, and she's going to come into this dirty place and see the extreme contradiction. But I mean, and that's it's like when you're really vulnerable and open up. It doesn't even have to be someone you live with per se, but someone you're very close with, and you know, it could be a partner, a romantic partner, that you have nowhere to hide. That's kind of what he's feeling here, is like, oh no, I've been exposed. Or even better, in his case, he accidentally kind of exposed himself. And now he's looking to shut the door. But unfortunately, he like gave her the key. So it's like, oh no, how am I going to crawl back into my shell that I've done this? And I think in real life, we experience that. But when in a healthy relationship, it's supposed to be that you open yourself up and you're vulnerable and the person doesn't take advantage of you. And I don't think Liza is of their temperament to take advantage of him, and the text will prove that out, but he's just so broken and afraid and self-conscious that it's his own ego that I think he can't take the hit. He can't take being seen as vulnerable and seen as embarrassing and seen as dirty and broke. And he knows that she's going to come see that. And the very fact that there's a chance that she may use that against him is just tearing him apart.
Exactly. And we see this vacillation occur in which he wildly shifts between, I will crush her, this is good, her crying last night was good, I will be able to now properly, you know, get her into a space that I can destroy her. But at the same time, being absolutely tortured at the prospect of really this lowly prostitute, because that's what she is in this society, coming and seeing him. And he even says in a moment of hysteria, I cried running about the room. She'll come. She is certain to come. If not today, she will come tomorrow. She'll find me out. The damnable romanticism of these pure hearts. Oh, the vileness. Oh, the silliness. Oh, the stupidity of these wretched sentimental souls. Why? How fail to understand? How could one fail to understand? And he was in great confusion. So you see this like almost like a praise kind of these, the helpless romantic soul that seeks to be uplifted. And then
right, he hates it. Himself.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And he hates what happened last night, because I'm convinced that at least some part in the speech, he lost control of himself, and he felt that he tipped his hand and was like, yeah, I am one of these sentimental souls, but I'm just so bitter and broken that I won't let anyone else ever experience it. And if I accidentally do, I'll just pretend it was a joke. And that's what he's doing here. And he's looking down on her for exactly the same thing he not only did he do last night himself, but he was purposefully trying to, you know, build these emotions in her.
You're gonna have to clarify this for me, because I'm looking through a glass darkly at these passages, but it seems to me that he says that he wants to tell her all, that he would be bold and cheerful when she comes, and you know, there would be this lofty idealism once again, and then he would acknowledge her love. And then he began to feel vulgar about himself, and he put out his tongue to himself about this idea of living together, and starts to, again, this like wild vacillation in which like the reader is left totally confused. You know, I'm looking.
Yeah. If you note, right above the part where he says, I'd go in on this vein until I myself would be nauseated, would end by sticking my tongue out at my own self. In the paragraph above that, it says, in short, I talk myself into some sort of European George Sandian incredible noble refinement. And so George Sand is a French romanticist who would see this sort of redemptive storyline from a prostitute in the same sort of social class that Liza was in. And so he's kind of playing out this trope that he was playing out last night, and he's kind of falls. He talks himself into the same trance that he was in before. And then he goes in the exact same circle where he's like, no, that's, that's from a book. That's not what I think, right? And he's like, I would make fun of someone if they talked like that, but I'm talking like that, so I should make fun of me. And then he's like, but it really would be romantic. And then he's like, no, I'm a fool.
So it leads me to a question of who the heck is this guy?
It's a great question.
Because, you know, because the thing is that he's saying who thinks like that and he's thinking like that. Is there no authentic thought or feeling? No original belief? There's nothing about him of a sort of substance.
Some of the commentary and secondary sources I've read about this, some latch onto that a lot more seriously. And Joseph Frank went as far as saying that the fact that it mentions him nourishing himself on these romantic books, and he talks about it like these references crop up all the time. And then under the George Sand quote, there is a quote from that Nekrasov poem that starts the chapter. And so it's like they make the point that he's always been essentially a dreamer. And so, like, he doesn't really have a personality. He has a lot. He's adopted a lot of fictional personalities and kind of steps into them. And so it's like the only real authentic part of him that you see is unfortunately the vile part, because that's not from the books. That's just him reacting. And so some people go further and kind of push that point where it's like, who does he even have a core? Like, or is he just adopted other people's thoughts so deeply that he doesn't really have his own?
I wonder if this could be related to any sort of the vapidity that we see in social media trends today. And I don't want to be like another boring podcast that's like, oh, I hate social media. I hate technology. Yeah, social media bad, book good.
Don't listen to this podcast.
Exactly.
Attached to social
media. Exactly, exactly. It never made sense to me, that podcast.
Yeah, we should get on AM radio.
Nice. There is something to be said about social media, though, in this, because you can see, in this case, for him, it's the reading of popular books, right? And I would assume that they're popular. So this kind of picking up of personalities that aren't really his. And it's the same way that even today, people pick up these cultural trends that may be found online. They do things only to show the highlight reels of their life through the lens of social media. Clothing is picked because of things that they may see on Instagram or TikTok. Poses, ways of talking, content that is choose to produce or to be consumed is based on that. But you meet such people and you have to end up asking yourself the question, where are they as a person?
How deeply buried is your authentic self? Yeah.
Right. Is your personality, and not to like be overly critical at anybody who takes like Instagram photos of their, you know, brunches with their girlfriends or that's an interesting question too, right? Because then I have to ask myself, if I'm trying to perceive what I'm doing through a lens based on what other people would want to consume from me, am I being me? And I know that's like a really confusing sentence, but if you can follow along with that train of thought, essentially what I would be asking is,
right, how many poses are you taking? Mm-hmm. And how much can mm-hmm. you pose before you're no longer yourself?
Right. Exactly. And it does pose that, like, you know, is the underground or is in the living underground is simply to be formed by cultural milieu.
Right. I think it's helpful to return to kind of the point of this story is that he is kind of lampooning Chevronesky. And I think the point of the over romanticism, not only just making fun of the time that he grew up and that he kind of was an amateur writer at the time and first published, but this idea that Chevronesky sees the world and like in such a way that everything is going to work out perfectly and everyone's going to reconcile, and what is to be done. There's these similar tropes where, you know, the prostitute saved because everyone just talks it through and, oh yeah, you're right, that does make sense, here you go. And it's like it's just a very utopian way of looking at the world. These romantic ideas kind of fuel that. And so part of the reason he wrote this was to say, okay, well, what if people aren't perfect and utopian? Like, what if they are a little broken, or in this case, a lot broken? And, you know, like, you can't just assume everyone in your society is going to be perfect. Like, there are going to be people like this. And I think that's either how he ends the first, or it's the opening of the first chapter where he talks about like these people do exist, and I'm sure of it. Nevertheless, such persons as the composer of these notes not only exist in our society, but indeed must exist, considering the circumstances under which our society has generally been formed. And so it's like he's trying to make the point that these people exist and you can't just ignore them. And maybe not to this extremity, but people who are bitter and just non-utopian exist, and you can't ignore that in your ideology. Because you can't just assume if you just turn on rational egoism, all of a sudden everyone's going to be redemptive and utopian.
Yeah, not at all. It's definitely not the case. And even with the material gains that we've experienced in our own Western society, as we talked about in an earlier episode, is that even because of that progress, we still haven't seemed to have met the measure of what would be required to even come close to anything that would be utopian by anybody's definition, especially Chernyshevsky's. And so empirically speaking, it just hasn't panned itself out. And it was especially true just the same in Dostoevsky's time, as he's pointing out and as you've pointed out.
Right, because the idea was that, you know, we talk about rational egoism and we think about it more aligned with capitalism. Like, oh, I'm going to do what's good for me, or like Ayn Rand or something. But for Chernyshevsky, the idea was to say, you should do what's best for you. And then it's so obvious the next step is that it's good to help other people because that's better for you as a society. Therefore, you'll immediately do it. And you just have to read anything Ayn Rand read to realize people can take that first step without coming to the second premise very easily. Also,
to go back to what we were talking about in terms of the layers of inauthenticity that may cover up your authenticity, even Dostoevsky was warning about the spider web network of railroads and telegrams that were springing up across Russia during his time. He mentions that in The Brothers Karamazov, where he talks about how railroads and, you know, telegraph poles. It was either in The Brothers Karamazov or Demons, I don't remember exactly, where he does have a passage in there where he talks about how this connection across the country and the receiving of media and news in an instance has kind of made our local communal experiences trivial.
Yeah,
and has really destroyed destroyed.
He saw that very much as Western influence that should be avoided. And unfortunately, it brought out quite a bit of anti-Semitism because those projects were usually backed by Jewish money. But yeah, he was very, later in his life especially, he was very, very anti-Western influence, especially railroads.
So it does kind of, in my mind, I mean, besides the anti-Semitism part, right? But it does bring up this kind of interesting thought about technology. But I think we should move on to Apollon, who is one of your favorites.
Everyone's his favorite servant. Character.
Yes. And how much he hates him. Did you want to go ahead and just start
on
that
one? So the underground man has this servant, this manservant, which doesn't make a lot of sense to us because we were like, he's really poor, but he has a servant. He serves in the government service, so he has essentially a social rank. Think of it as akin to some sort of military rank. And he has a manservant, but he's like a very, very poor manservant. And the manservant has nothing but indignation for the underground man because he knows that the underground man is this vile, touchy, just mess of a person. And they have this kind of game of chicken every month where it's this test of will where the underground man owes him his salary and Apollon is just very snooty and he's so dignified and he knows the underground man is not dignified. And so every month when his salary is due, instead of walking up to the underground man and saying, may I please have my salary, which would be very demeaning, Apollon will just very silently and non-verbally communicate his disdain for the underground man until he gives him his salary, including walking into the room while the underground man is sitting there and just staring at him for 2 minutes, perfectly still, locking eyes. And the underground man is, you know, taking this as a test of will, which it is. And, you know, he's like, I'm not going to look away. I'll just stare at him until he leaves and I'll show him how powerful I am. And of course, he always breaks. And so he's always in this kind of constant struggle with his manservant who just has so much disdain for him. And he knows that he has not paid Apollo around this month because he spent all his money on this outing. And he's like, oh, if Lisa shows up and she's going to see Apollon and he's going to mock me in front of her and she's going to see that. So he's like, I got to pay Apollon, but I refuse to pay him until he comes to me. Like, this is the final, you know, test of will.
Why do you keep calling him Apollon?
Oh, because I keep imagining there's an ER in there.
Apollon.
Redact that. Yeah, my bad.
Yeah, I mean, like, our audience is already going to be pissed off at us because you keep saying Chevronesky and I keep saying Chertyshevsky. And so
yeah,
it's
you're
like,
right.
So like there's this like, if we just keep, and you say Lisa and I say Liza. So like the,
oh, I mean, different translation than you. So,
I mean, our audience is like, I have no idea how to pronounce anything in this book.
You see, if you had let me do the 30-minute translation intro at the beginning, all of this would be cleared up.
I want Austin back.
Yeah, me too. Oh, it's just gone down a hill since then.
Yeah, I think that when we're talking about Apollon, I just think of somebody who just sees through it all and is this kind of thorn in the side of the underground man, in which he's just constantly exposing him without even saying anything. You know, again, that vulnerability comes back and he just stares at him. And there's this utter shame and this kind of deep-seated judgment that just pours forth from him as the underground man just yells at him to go away, and then he slowly turns and walks out and then comes back in 2 hours later and he's like, I hate you so much, go away. And he just exposes him just by looking at him, just by looking at the man that he is, exposes him for how cheap and vile he is. And so, this kind of natural, you know, it's okay. There's this kind of almost a natural law argument in where the underground man knows, despite how he contrives this inner narrative about himself and who he is and what he should be, there's an inherent moral knowledge present.
Yeah, he's like that that consciousness that he doesn't really have, but it's like it's the public that he's been avoiding, that authenticity of someone knowing what you're who you really are, and he lives with it. So he's just like this physical embodiment of this public that he's trying to avoid, and he's sitting here like, maybe that's why he's crazy, is because he thinks he can escape, but he really can't because his manservant's always there staring at him.
And then we enter into the climactic action, right? In which is very funny, because if you think about your three-act structure, right, Dostoevsky literally waits for the climax to be at the end of the book, and the falling action is like a precipitous 90-degree drop-off. And Liza shows up.
Just when he thought he would.
Exactly. Shows up, and he freaks out. And brings her in, and he is a complete mess. The apartment's a mess, and he's screaming at Apollon to bring the tea, go get tea, go get snacks for her. And he's screaming at him, and it takes him forever, and he has to give the salary up, and then he finally goes and does it. And he's just shrieking, I will kill him, I will kill him.
He says, it opens with, I stood before her, Liza, crushed, humiliated, sickening, ashamed, and I think smiling as I struggled desperately to wrap myself in my tattered quilted robe. Well, exactly as I had imagined the other day in my fit of desperation, which is, he just like, I know if she comes here, I'm going to wrap myself in this dirty robe and she's going to know what I am. And then this whole thing plays out. And then he tries the subterfuge, which is not very good cover when you're crying. I am not ashamed of my poverty. On the contrary, I regard my poverty with pride. I am poor, but honorable. One can be poor, but honorable, I muttered. It's like, it's not, she hasn't even said anything yet. It's like, you probably could have just been like, oh yeah, by the way, this is how I live. He's not very suave.
He's not. And she is once again being vulnerable, timid, and straightforward. And he's sitting there awkwardly with this tea that Apollon brings with these snacks. And they're sitting there in awkward silence for 5-10 minutes pass. And he then just has this massive outburst at her. And he just basically admits everything. He begins asking her, why did you come? Please tell me why you've come here. Even though he invited her, you know, he's just terrified. And then he, in one burst, says, I'll tell you, my good girl, why you have come. You've come because I talked sentimental stuff to you then. So now you are soft as butter and longing for the fine sentiments again. So you may as well know that I was laughing at you then. And I'm laughing at you now, which is not true. Why are you shuddering? Yes, I was laughing at you. I have been insulted just before at dinner by the fellows who came that evening before me. I came to you meaning to thrash one of them, an officer, but I didn't succeed. I didn't find him. I had to avenge the insult on someone to get back my own again. You turned up. I vented my spleen on you and laughed at you. I had been humiliated, so I wanted to humiliate. I had been treated like a rag, so I wanted to show you my power. That's what it was. And you imagine I had come there on purpose to save you. Yes, you imagine that. You imagine that. And he just continues to lay into her.
Yeah. And so it's like the natural response from Liza would be to get up, slap him maybe, and just leave and be like, oh, you were disgusting. I came here because I thought you were an honorable person who is going to try to help me. And, you know, I thought maybe you were worthwhile, but I find out you're some sort of scum. But he goes on that whole tangent, and then it's the reaction that shocks him. And he says, but suddenly a strange thing happened. I had been so accustomed to thinking and imagining everything according to books and picturing everything in the world as I had previously made it up in fantasy, that at that moment, I didn't even grasp the meaning of this strange circumstance. What happened was this. Liza, more than I had imagined, Liza, insulted and humiliated by me, understood much more than I had imagined. She understood out of all this, all his ranting, what a woman, if she loves sincerely, will always understand before else, all else. She understood that I was myself unhappy. And she then cuts up and comforts him because she realizes that she was unhappy in the brothel. She knows what it's like to be in this lowly, horrible place. And she has an extreme empathy for him. And that's just the last opposite thing that he would ever expect because of how horrible he is.
And so there are two quotes to add to that. Surely by now you must realize that I shall never forgive you for having found me in this wretched dressing gown. Just as I was flying at Apollon like a spiteful cur, the savior, the former hero, was flying like a mangy, unkempt sheepdog at his lackey, and the lackey was jeering at him. And I shall never forgive you for the tears that I could not help shedding before you just now, like some silly woman put to shame. And I'll never.
Yeah. In that paragraph, I circled every time he says you in like an accusatory way. And he accuses, it's like, it's all about her, this horrible thing that he's done. And he says the word you six times in that paragraph where he's like, I'll never forgive you. You've done this to me. And you're just like, what are you talking about? But it's the sheer just this being found out by someone that he doesn't even really need to respect. She's very lowly on the social ladder, but his ruse has been found out. And it's like all of a sudden, he's so selfish that all he can think about is blaming her for showing up when he asked her to.
But then here's the line. Here's the line. At this point, there was a revulsion in my heart, too. Then she suddenly rushed to me, threw her arms around me, and burst into tears. I, too, could not restrain myself and sobbed as I never had before. They won't let me. I can't be good. I managed to articulate. Then I went to the sofa, fell on it face downwards, and sobbed on it for a quarter of an hour in genuine hysterics.
Yeah,
that's the line. That's the famous
that's
line.
That's the whole book. Yeah.
Yep.
That's we were talking about what's the core of his personality. Like, what is the absolute most core part of him? I think that's it. Is that is his core problem.
He cuts off. They won't let me. Right. So people get caught up on that.
Right.
There's an ellipsis. So people get caught up. They won't let me. I can't be good. The reason why that's like that. Here, I'm going to stake my claim on this. He corrects himself. It's not a conjoined statement in where they won't let him be good and he can't be good. He's correcting himself. There's the true moment of truth. There's the true moment of authenticity. They won't let me. No, I can't be good. It's a correction. It's a correction.
It's final, not like taking responsibility.
Right.
For
it's the final admittance.
His life.
Exactly. Exactly. Why was I ashamed? I don't know, but I was ashamed. The thought too came into me into my overwrought brain that our parts now were completely changed, that she was now the heroine, while I was just such a crushed and humiliated creature as she had been before me that night, 4 days before. And all this came into my mind during the minutes I was lying on my face on the sofa. Wow. I mean, you know what? I have a quote. Where's my phone?
Well, Aaron gets his phone.
I got it.
You think.
It's a Flannery O'Connor quote, I think. Where is it?
Yeah, but is there violence in it?
Yes, I hope so.
Oh, okay. Is there Catholic imagery?
Where is she at? Here it is. Everyone needs, of course, to be lifted up. There is something in us as storytellers and as listeners to stories that demands the redemptive act, that demands that what falls at least be offered the chance to be restored. The reader of today looks for this motion, and rightly so, but what he has forgotten is the cost of it. His sense of evil is diluted or lacking altogether, and so he has forgotten the price of restoration. There are ages when it is possible to woo the reader. There are others where something more drastic is necessary. Why do I bring that up? I bring that up and I draw the connection because we would hope that there would just be that redemption, right? They would realize there's a need.
Yeah, you'd hope that would be the end of the book.
Right. Or you would even hope that it would be simpler than this, right? Would not even to go to the end of the book, just that it would be simpler than this, that it would just be love. That there would be an acknowledgement, that there would be a self-awareness amongst the individual, the underground man. And there would just be an assent to what is right. And it would be easy. It would be simple. But it's not the case. The redemptive act demands and requires a price to be paid. That's fundamental to Dostoevsky's philosophy, to his writing, to the narrative choices that are being made in this book, is that it is not easy to be redeemed. And in fact, what we're going to see is that for many, it is not possible because they won't let it be possible. You can be, as a reader, screaming out, hoping, wishing, praying in this book that it would just change course. Please don't go down that road. And it happens. But the funny thing is, that is the common state. We act as if this is the exception to the rule. But the reason why this book is amazing, and the reason why Dostoevsky stands up, and the reason why we are covering him, is because his work and this book is showing us what is commonplace. It is the rest of the fantasy novels. It is the rest of the romance novels that are showing the exception to the rule. This is the rule.
Yeah. That we're dirty, selfish, and broken.
Come on.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up because his lifelong goal, and Dostoevsky gets panned a lot for the end of Crime and Punishment. Maybe I shouldn't just spoil Crime and Punishment for everyone. But his great goal in life was to write a three-part novel called The Life of a Great Sinner, where he thought that his life mission was to write this story that convincingly and in a very realistic manner showed the character arc of a great sinner who becomes, mired in all this sin, kind of imagined like Notes from Underground, but is convincingly redeemed over a long period of time in such a way that it isn't cheap or confusing or, not believable. And so it's like his great mission in life was to do this convincingly. And so it's like it shows how much he understood what Aaron was saying, that redemption is not something you can just have at the end of a book. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, yeah, that I buy that. Like it has to come with a long journey and a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of sacrifice.
And then we have the falling action. And so there's a line here. I conquered myself, how I hated her and how I was drawn to her at that minute. And so you would think he's made it, or you would hope. And again, to bring up the marriage analogy, there is this kind of hate and love that exists at the same time, because not because of a legitimate hate, but more because I hate you because you've exposed me. And I hate you because you love me, even though I've been exposed. And there's that kind of like dissatisfaction, right? That comes with that. This kind of, please don't look at me because I'm ashamed. Please don't love me because I'm unlovable.
That ego. Yep.
Right, right. And so you would hope that it's over. She warmly and rapturously embraced me. This, like, this is the moment, right? This is
what we're clinging to. Right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, we're clinging to. And then you turn the page. And there's just, in my edition, there's just three more pages. And it's enough. It's just enough to shatter it. I did not imagine love except as a struggle. I began it always with hatred and ended it with moral subjugation. And afterwards, I never knew what to do with the subjugated object. And what is there to wonder at in that, since I had succeeded in so corrupting myself, since I was so out of touch with real life, as to have actually thought of reproaching her and putting her to shame for having come to me to hear fine sentiments, and did not even guess that she had come not to hear fine sentiments, but to love me. Because to a woman, all reformation, all salvation from any sort of ruin and all moral renewal is included in love and can only show itself in that form. I would say that's a statement of his philosophy in a line.
Yeah, I have above that first sentence you read. To me, loving meant tyrannizing and flaunting my moral superiority. And then my translation says, instead of fine sentiment, it says pathetic words.
And so I don't think we see the moment in which he kind of basically breaks her.
You see, like in what you just read, like he's so mad that he like misjudged her, and that he judged her according to his own character. Right. And so that's why he's blind to the salvation she was offering. And he does like just the worst thing possible out of malice. And that's what it says in my edition. It's his episode to destroy her. He says, I suddenly ran up to her, seized her hand, opened it, put in ... and closed it again. Then I immediately turned and quickly sprang away into the opposite corner so at least I wouldn't see. And then it says, I was about to lie just now to write that I had done it by accident in confusion without thought. I had lost my head. But I don't want to lie, and therefore will say straight out, I opened her hand and slipped her ... out of malice. And so it turns out that what he had done was slipped her a ruble note.
Five ruble note.
$5, yeah, five or ten, I was gonna, sure. So he slips her this note in this manner of paying her because she's
for her
a prostitute.
Time. Yeah, yeah.
And dealing her the ultimate insult in order to cover his own actual vulnerable and real human emotion. Because in the end, it's like saying, this was just a joke. I got you again. Look, I've crushed you. Like, just like I told you, I said I would. I was just doing this to build up your hopes. And now I've crushed you again. When really, those really were his real emotions. He really was genuinely crying and actually being loved for the first time. And he immediately covers his tracks out of malice.
And she still remains the hero because she crumples up the note and leaves it. And he doesn't even see her leave it, and she just leaves. Which means that she continues to maintain her dignity and her belief and her identity.
Yeah, and she really loved him for the potential for what he was. And she loved him even though he wasn't the like dreamy prince who was going to sweep her off her feet, because she came to his place and he lived in squalor. And you know, that's the first step she could have turned around and been like, oh, big mistake. And then she goes in and it turns out he's not only poor, but he's also crazy and spiteful and like wildly yelling at people and like completely self-conscious as a vile person. But what she sees when she walks in is not this vile person, but someone who's really suffering. And so that she offers herself to him. And then he rejects her out of pure vileness, and she still leaves without making it about that, about making it about money and leaving with, you know, saving what she could out of this situation.
Right. There's a sacrifice. There's a sacrifice that's present. And he just kind of falls back into it where he tries to convince himself once again that what he did was a fine thing, because the kind of suffering that he's given her, the resentment that he's handed her will just kind of stick with her and it will purify her, is what he says, which is just sick. And he says, I never met her again, never heard anything of her, even though he does go chasing after her to kind of, I guess, because once again, he has that consciousness about what is occurring and how he's basically shutting the door on his own redemption, which is just a very interesting thing to see play out. And once again, just that being the common practice in which we can be more, that we have the capability in many moments of life, probably, in which we can be, in Dostoevsky's eyes, be redeemed of this condition. And yet we are the ones who shut the door. And we would like to blame other people. Like he says, they won't let me, right? But he was the one who shut the door on himself, and he's aware of that. And I think after this moment, as the frame narrative ends and we basically are caught up to the present time where the narrative switches again, he says, I've been stuck in the underground. After that moment, nothing ever changed for me. Because
the last event where he's the last open door for him to get out of the underground, and it walked right into his hands. Even after it was just an accident, even though he was just messing with her, and this is his last chance for redemption, falls right into his lap and he slams the door. And then you get the first half of the book.
Yeah. And then he actually laughs at the reader. We are oppressed at being men with a real individual body and blood. We are ashamed of it. We think it a disgrace and try to contrive to be some sort of impossible generalized man. We are stillborn, and for generations past have been begotten, not by living fathers. And that suits us better and better. We are developing a taste for it. Soon we shall contrive to be born somehow from an idea. But enough, I don't want to write more from underground. The notes of this paradoxalist do not end here, however. He could not refrain from going on with them, but it seems to us that we may stop here. That's how it ends. I mean, there's the story. I mean, we knew from the onset, but for some reason we're so fixated on seeing that redemptive arc play out. And he just ends up turning around and saying, you're no different than me. You're also born and have oppressed yourself, because I guess it, to hear him put it, is that we've never been given the example of something other than underground.
Right. Yeah, the fact that he turns around, and just when you hate him at the absolute most, he turns around and says, well, isn't that just me and you? Aren't we both like this? And he even kind of makes the fact that he's like, you know, perhaps I'm even better than you because I'm at least aware of it.
And maybe he says, what? We're all cripples. We're all divorced from life. And it's just a really, really rough punch in the teeth to go through. But I want to leave this with a little bit of a bright silver lining. And that's Liza. Liza's not him. And if we can hold on to what he would call the hopeless ideal, regardless of what happens to us from these people underground, at least for Dostoevsky, is that we can still love. We don't have to choose.
Even in the face of horrible vileness. And I mean, and taking her as the protagonist in the redemptive character, I mean, she's intentionally coming from the worst material circumstance of anyone in this book, and yet is still overcoming that material circumstance and being the one who loves past what she should. She should be the most bitter and resentful, right? And, you know, that was such a prevalent idea at the time, was that he was combating, is, you know, that material circumstances is really all that matters. Like, of course, people are going to commit these crimes or in these material circumstances. It's a foregone conclusion and we can't really blame them. And Dostoevsky was very much against this idea. And I think we see it a lot in our own day. And I mean, it's such a touchy subject because you don't want to be like, oh, well, you're poor. Like, just get out of your situation. But his point is less about social work, which he always worked towards. He was a social revolutionary. I mean, who went and was exiled for his beliefs and trying to make it better for the people on the bottom of society. But his point was always metaphysical and ethical, that even in the worst situation, even in the prison camp, like we discussed in earlier episodes, you can still overcome.
Yeah, it's a really somber note, but I guess that's kind of what we signed up for when we picked this book.
Yeah, that was such a sad ending after all this time. Did you know it was going to end like that?